How's it go? Something like, sing, heavenly muse. Does that ring a bell? Sing, heavenly muse. Of the awful wrath of great Achilles. It's a whole epic about anger. I'm sure some of you know Ed Brown, or as he prefers to be known, Edward Brown. Some of us have known him for many years, and he's a pretty cool guy. Recently, there's been a kind of upset with San Francisco's Zen Center, and they don't want him to teach there anymore, which was for some of us a big shock. And it's sort of like this is another epic about anger or something. But there was a retreat day at Green Gulch Farm some weeks ago, and someone who was there afterwards wrote a letter to the powers at Zen Center and said that she had been upset by something that Edward had, she felt, said during one of the talks. And so there was some back and forth about that. And I think maybe there was some suggestion that Edward should come and, I don't know, explain himself. And I think that upset him a little bit. And he said, "I didn't say that. Could you listen to the recordings? And you'll see that I didn't say that." And apparently they hadn't listened to the recordings, which was very strange. And so I guess there was some more back and forth, and Edward was, you know, as he gets. And those of you who know him know that he has a temper. He also has a very great heart. He's a very wonderful guy. But at some point, I sort of got a feeling that the response from the institution was, you're too angry with us, and you've upset too many people, and you shouldn't teach her anymore. And so there's been kind of a lot of ripples from this, and various people on various sides, some of which don't actually exist, but anyway, there's people there. And to watch it unfold was very painful, and also a demonstration of how greed and anger and confusion that isn't actually living in any one person can mushroom and distort a situation such that there's an outcome like this. Someone who has been practicing since he was very young and was ordained by Suzuki Roshi is sort of excluded from the community where he spent so many years and affected the growth of. As you know, he's written a number of cookbooks, and the Tassajara Bread Book and others, which are quite celebrated. And I'd forgotten that many years ago, when he wrote the Tassajara Bread Book, the then abbot told him, well, you should make sure that all of the proceeds from any sales go to Zen Center. And so he has never been able to profit from any sales of that book, which I'm sure are many, many, many thousands at this point. And he completely supports himself by talks, workshops, book sales, and so forth. So to be told that he would not be able to teach at Zen Center was quite a blow. So I don't know if some of you heard about that, but it's been on my mind. And as I say, those of you who know Edward, you probably find yourself leaning one way or another. Somebody told me that he had something of a tendency to speak at times bitterly about his relationship with the Zen Center. And I guess these have accumulated some difficult feelings on the part of people who are running that institution. I personally didn't know that. It was Edward who led the first training period at Tassajara in 1983 after Zentatsu Baker left the community, and I was there for that, and I remember him quite fondly. Much later, when I was prior, the Tanto at Tassajara, and Edward was giving a cooking workshop. And I don't know, maybe I shouldn't laugh, but I was walking by the area there, the student eating area, where they'd set up all the benches and stuff and cutting boards. And I heard Edward saying, "Do you suppose you could just try it the way I'd like you to try it just once? How about just once you do it my way?" And I had to snicker as I was walking by because, you know, this is Ed, you know. But apparently, there had to be a meeting with the people in the workshop because they were upset. So it's like, oh, you don't know him, you know. He didn't mean anything by that. So I guess I'm bringing this up because of the frightful power of anger. And I speak as kind of an angry person. So I have some experience with that, and I've practiced for many years to acknowledge when anger arises and to give it enough space so that it does not erupt in karmically patterned ways that are destructive. Okay. So if we read what's his name, Shantideva, who's very popular in certain circles, and as you know, in his Bodhisattva Charyavatara, he quite inveighs against anger as, you know, horrible. And it certainly can be, but in our kind of modern frame of mind, we have to be careful that we do not stumble into thinking that what he meant was that you kind of, if anger arises, you strangle it. You kill it, and you bury it somewhere so it will never come back. It's like, yeah, you know what? I don't think that works anymore, if it ever did. Personally, I don't think it ever did. And that to relate that way to our emotions is actually sick-making. It will make us ill. So instead, to cultivate the body-mind in a way that acknowledges how much space there is for the arising and unfolding of emotions is a way of allowing anger to express, but not to force us into acting out, right, in our old patterned ways of behavior, which generally, at one time, very often, they were actually adaptive, and they actually helped us survive. But usually, by the time we are adults, those adaptive patterns aren't adaptive anymore. So we need a new way of being able to relate to the awful power of arising emotions, whether we want to label them positive or negative. We have to give them their due. And as my teacher likes to say, the one thing you don't want to do is sit on a volcano and try to make it stay there. Right? That is not a good idea. Right? So what can you do instead? Well, fortunately, our practice is such that we begin to recognize the spaciousness of the body-mind and realize there's actually a lot of room in there. And when big feeling comes up, there's actually big room. So once I become acquainted with the remarkable innate balance of this body-mind, I can give space to an arising feeling. And once that wave passes, then we realize there are actually quite a few other options. I don't have to pick up my frying pan and smack someone in the head with it, or throw something out the window, or scream at someone in a way that's injurious to them. So this is kind of a parable about that, and a reminder for myself and all of us that everyone's anger can be sung by the heavenly muse. This is not some ghastly evil to exterminate. We also don't have to run around like Achilles and chop people up either. So this is one way of looking at relating to our body-mind that it may not be easy to see the connection with earlier Buddhist teachings, which are pre-psychological, you might say. And even though you see books and so forth that say Buddhist psychology, it looks very different from psychology as most of us have grown up with in the West since the good Dr. Freud said, why don't we look at this a little differently? And it's also very different from some of the more orthodox approaches to spirituality and religion, where all of those, inconvenient arisings were regarded as adventitious. Namely, there, it's not me, it's coming from out there, and it's a demon, right? So all I got to do is be on my guard against demons. And when they show up, kill them with, whatever, prayer or something, holy water. And interestingly, that sort of approach is still quite well established in, for instance, Eastern Christianity. There's still in those very few and dwindling monastic institutions like Monastery of St. Catherine and Sinai, and maybe there are still a couple of places left, maybe one in Palestine and maybe one in Syria, where the monastics actually still use that language of demons. It's like, it'll be fine if you just kill all those demons. That's like, okay, well, hope that works for you. But I find it hard as a person who's well acquainted with demons to relate to those phenomena as though they were being inflicted on me by something outside, rather than, no, this is the manifestation of karma in the midst of the vitality of this being, whatever it is. And this all started floating around in my lumber room of a mind, as usual on my way up here on the train. I realized I had once again forgotten to bring a Dharma book, so I'm frantically looking around. What can I do? Is there a Amtrak magazine in here? I can find something to talk about. Well, fortunately, I discovered in my Kindle, I had a copy of Volume 1 of the Empty Valley Collection, a marvelous one of the Chan and Zen collections of dialogues. This one, put together by our great ancestor, Totsu I Ching, and he collected the stories and wrote some verses and also some commentary. And the story that this time caught my attention this is one of the very short ones. Okay. In this one, a monastic asks ancestor Totsu, what's it like when the vast flaming conflagration at the end of the universe consumes everything? And Totsu says, frightfully cold. It's like, frightfully cold. So this was an aspect of Buddhist cosmology that was prevalent in Buddhist time back in India. The notion was that there are days and nights of Brahma, and during the day of Brahma, there is a universe and all the unfoldings that go together with that, and that at the end of that period, the universe is consumed in fire and there is no trace left until the next day of Brahma begins. And interestingly, I was watching YouTube the other day, and there was a very engaging video featuring the great physicist Roger Penrose speaking with another chap, and he was saying that there is still some controversy about what is, you know, the fate of the universe. But he said, Penrose said, there is good reason to feel that there is something like this cyclic arising and passing away of universes. Mathematically, it is justifiable, and according to the various physics theories, and as at least some physicists feel like, this is something like this probably happens. In other words, things arise, they unfold, and then they are wiped away. And then something else comes up. So this is just one of these interesting places where the old wisdom and the new wisdom seem to be in some kind of synchrony. So, supposedly, at the end of all things, there's a tremendous flame out of the whole universe, and everything is burned up. And here is ancestor Totsu saying, when asked what that's like, frightfully cold. It's like, okay, so here's this good-hearted monastic asking about a feature of the teaching and having sort of the rug pulled out from under him in true Chan fashion. Poor guy. That particular collection of stories is celebrated for the way that Totsu manages to go away. Use poetic symbolism to reflect a variety of teachings and points of view and these very lively Zen attitudes. So heat and cold are they don't have a fixed meaning in Chan and Zen. Some of the typical points of view are heat is sometimes the body and mind of the sentient being is, you know, very, very, very hot. And one of the remedies is quiet cultivation, which brings great cooling. Right? So which is it at the end of the universe? I know, of course, some of you may be thinking, well, didn't Buddha say that's one of those things that is not really worth worrying about? Didn't he, in fact, use the term the avyakrita vastuni, is the Sanskrit expression, which means things that are kind of useless, right? And there's like, I don't know, 60-some-odd questions. And one of them is, is the universe eternal or not? And if it's not, what happens? And what was there before? And what will be there after? And it's like, no, no, no. None of this is going to help us. Right? Still, being humans, we think about this stuff. Right? What's going to happen to everything? And maybe more intimately, what's going to happen to us? Right? So, there are rote responses to these questions. But in Zen, mostly we're taught, you know, those aren't going to be very helpful. So nowadays, and maybe, you know, this is nothing new, sometimes people will look for an answer that is agreeable to them, or that maybe someone else told them this is a good answer. And then they will kind of absorb that and sort of tattoo it on their minds. And that's always going to be the answer for them. And sometimes this is how sacred scriptures are related to, as the source of completely reliable answers. So people memorize this stuff, and whenever there's an occasion, out it comes, and they're kind of in that corner. So in Chan and Zen, it's like we're encouraged, you know what, don't do that. And when someone asks you, what happens at the end of the universe, tell them what you think. Tell them how it looks. Tell them how you feel. Ask them how they feel. But don't settle on one thing and stick there. And during your life, there will be occasions when the heavenly muse will be singing of your awful wrath. And, you know, you can sing right along with. And as you become acquainted with how much space there is in this body-mind, you won't feel compelled to do this, that, or the other thing. And then sometimes the anger that is like the fire at the end of the universe, sweeping all before it, sometimes that's actually helpful. And there's room for a new universe. You can't really plan on that. So I'm just saying, you got to be right there for whatever the circumstances are. Or you might find yourself falling back on something remembered, something memorized, something that worked sometime before. And your options then will be more limited. And the possibility of turning the situation into something that will actually be helpful, those are much fewer. Now, you know, hopefully we, you know, we'll be willing to make space for each other. And there'll be times when our, how we are relating to the phenomena of our body-mind may not be so skillful. Okay? And when that happens, it's good if we have enough commitment to one another to stay with each other in that storm and not retreat to our various corners or kick someone out. Now, what if that someone is like dangerous, which sometimes happens? It's like, well, we gotta think of something. But mostly that doesn't happen. Mostly it's just Edward saying, could you just do it the way I asked for once? And it's like, okay, well, all right. Take it easy there, Edward. And he usually, he calms down from those spikes very fast. And he's the same sweet, loving man that he always was. He'll sometimes tell the story, you know. He was Tenzo at Tasahara, and Suzukiyoshi was there, and he was wrestling with something, you know, in the stove, and trying to get the bread pans in or something like that. And it finally dawned on him that someone was calling his name. He was like, what? I'm busy here. And he turns around, it's Suzukiyoshi, who was saying, Edward. And it was one of those moments where the space was suddenly there. And in that teacher-student mind space, there was nothing but room. And this was the first time he'd ever experienced that. And this was a joyful thing and something that encouraged him throughout his life. And I think maybe it was there too, at least, you know, after a moment of yelling at the person who wasn't chopping quite the way he was supposed to chop. And this is something he brings to his work with other people, his students. And when there are occasions where there's, it's got that feeling, this is sort of tense and difficult. It's so great if we can trust ourselves that it's okay to be in this space with that person or these people and allow there to be more possibilities rather than just, well, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I hate you. Get out of here. Or sometimes it's actually essential to say to someone, okay, hang on a minute. If you're going to hit me, this isn't going to work. So we need to fall back, regroup, and maybe come back again. But no hitting, right? No throwing things. no calling people horrible names? It's like, okay, we try to rule that out. And when we make mistakes, try to let our commitment allow us to be there with and for that person, those people, that circumstance, whatever it is. And then maybe, whatever it was, the anger can sweep the whole universe clean and we can start over again. Anyway, I will commit again to living that way, and I don't live with you guys so much, but if I did, I would try to commit to living that way. And usually when I come up here, you guys are very nice to me, and I realize that, well, you know what, they don't live with me day after day, so it's easy up here. And it's not that people where I live are not nice to me, but we have our moments, let's put it that way. So there's Ancestor Totsu saying, it's really cold when that goes down. And the puzzled monastic going, oh. I don't know what that's about. Speaking of anger, Totsu had a buddy, another celebrated Zen person named Shuifeng, and they used to hang out and travel together. And they had a funny relationship. There's these stories, for instance, Totsu and Shuifeng were hanging around outside, and Totsu points to a rock and says, all the Buddhas of antiquity are right there. And Shuifeng says, it's important to note that not a single one is not there. And Totsu looks at him and says, dullard. Okay. Another day, they're out. They're on the road to Luoyang or some such city. And Shuifeng asks Totsu, which is the branch here? Which is the road to Luoyang? Totsu gestures with his staff. And Shuifeng says something like, yes, and the true road is none of these places. And Totsu looks at him and says, dullard. And another time, they're out gardening. And Shuifeng says something like, we must manifest true mind. And Totsu has a rake, and he drops it on the ground in front of Shuifeng. Shuifeng says, maybe we better dig for it right now. And Totsu says, dullard. But apparently they were fond of each other. So many things are possible. Sweetheart. Yeah, so I'm still trying to do this thing where I write my own little poems for these stories. Will you allow me to share it with you? You can say no. Let's see.
You call promise is that only to the end of the universe?
The end of the universe, right? At least I think it is. The French have a saying, a winter without fire, old age without a home. There may come a time when the hearth holds nothing but ashes. Learn to warm your hands at the heart instead, and you will be master of every climate. No turning this way and that. Stop right where you are and let Ancestor Totsu take your hand. Well, I'm out of clever things to say or dumb things to say, so if you have a question or a comment. Okay. It's usually worse the second time, but all right. The French have a saying, winter without fire, old age without a home. There may come a time when the hearth holds nothing but ashes. Learn to warm your hands at the heart instead, and you will be master of every climate. No turning this way and that. Stop right where you are and let Ancestor Totsu take your hand. Okay, I'm going to escape now. Thank you very much.